Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Keeping your business fleet moving with service you can count on.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, with war unfolding in the Middle East, we talk to Dennis Staunton of the Irish Times about how the world got to this point and, more importantly, how we might get out. What really went on with Netflix's failed pursuit of Warner, and what does Paramount's victory mean for the economics of movies and news? Plus, why a woman who dropped out of college and worked as a plumber might spell disaster for Keir Starmer. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, it's the week of International Women's Day, and I wanted to start off by explaining just how much economic power women have in the world. Women are the primary decision makers for, or significantly influence, 85% of all consumer purchases globally. In the US, they control over 60% of all personal wealth. They control 92% of holiday spending decisions and are responsible for approximately 69% of all grocery shopping in Irish households, while doing 75% of the unpaid work in the world, might I add. So if you're in any sort of a consumer-focused business and not truly understanding women, you do so at your peril. Now, Keir Starmer has not had a good couple of days. He has been sidelined by America over its war with Iran, but the real danger to him may well lie closer to home. Last Thursday, a by-election took place in the constituency of Gorton and Denton, which is in Lancashire, and Labour had kept that seat for over 100 years. However, not anymore, as the Green Party's Hannah Spencer overturned a Labour majority of 13,480 and won with 14,980 votes. It got worse for Labour as Nigel Farage's Reform Party came second. What does all of this mean and what can we learn from it? Well, I'm delighted to be joined now by Lucy Fisher, who is the Whitehall editor at the Financial Times and host of the FT's Political Fix podcast. So first off, Lucy, what can you deduce from this? Because it's not just about Hannah Spencer, who's a plumber from a non-political family per se, winning a by-election here. There's a lot more to take from this, isn't there?
Well, look, I think that's right. I think what we're seeing here is the fragmentation of the vote on the left. And it's a huge problem for Labour and blows a hole in Keir Starmer's whole electoral strategy, which has been to try and combat the threat from the right, to try and make sure he is competing with voters who are either have gone or curious about going to the Reform UK party. And he has so far, you know, tried to argue that anyone who wants to stop Nigel Farage's party doing well has to vote for Labour as the only option. Well, clearly in Gorton and Denton, voters didn't buy that. They believed that the Greens were, you know, a viable alternative party on the progressive left. And therefore, you know, I think there's a lot of people in Labour who are bracing for the elections coming up in May in Scotland, Wales, and local councils all over England, who are now very concerned about the Green Party, you know, stealing votes from Labour on its left flank.
If we just think about the strategy that you're referring to there, that whole idea of focusing on the threat from the right, particularly Reform UK, and assuming that the left would be behind you, that's a Morgan McSweeney strategy. So since he's gone now, who do you think is really shaping the strategy? Or is it a where they're simply reacting to developments as they happen? Because as we know, and as we'll discuss today, there's a lot of events happening.
Well, there are a lot of events happening. You're right. You know, McSweeney's departure has left a lot up in the air because he was known to be wanting Starmer to tack to the right, particularly on areas like immigration. However, we're going to see the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, unveil some pretty tough policies on that front in a speech tomorrow. So there doesn't seem any deviation from the direction there. I think there is this sense that Starmer has to give ground to the soft left in his party following the aborted coup by Anna Sawar, the Scottish Labour leader earlier this month. And therefore, we might see some movement on other issues. There was some suggestion Rachel Reeves might have addressed unhappiness and growing demands for action on student loans, for example, in the spring forecast yesterday. That didn't happen. in a sense, we're in a holding pattern until the elections in May take place. But after that, I think there could be moves against Starmer's premiership, or he's going to have to show he is resetting his premiership in some way that, you know, forges confidence with the left in his party.
Could I go back to the point about immigration and particularly the spring statement that was had this week by Rachel Reeves? Because the watchdog now says new data on immigration by UK nationals means it's expected 200,000 fewer people in employment at the end of the decade relative to the forecast it drew up alongside Reeves's November budget. And yet, on the other hand, the Green Party are looking for more leniency when it comes to, not quite open borders, but more leniency when it comes to immigration. So what do you think the people who are voting for Hannah Spencer want?
Well, look, I think in some ways it's slightly hard to tell because, you know, she campaigned very heavily on the cost of living, quite mainstream issues that we would traditionally have associated with the Labour Party, you know, better public services, better education, better health, and so forth. But of course, the Green Party does have some fairly radical ideas on, for example, immigration, as you say, a more open border policy and welcoming more refugees. On drug policy, they want the legalization of even Class A drugs and for, you know, narcotics to be treated as you know, a health issue rather than a criminal justice issue. Zach Polanski, the Green leader, has talked about withdrawal from NATO, and while that doesn't exist as sort of official Green Party policy at the moment, that will, you know, be a cause of concern for people with more traditional and orthodox views on the defence of the realm. So one way in which the Greens sort of rise is interesting is it's certainly, you know, reinvigorating the battle of ideas in the UK and blowing apart some of the orthodoxies that had been very much settled issues among the main parties heretofore.
When you mention those points, legalising and regulating the sale of drugs, the migration policy, we'll say withdrawal from NATO, whether that becomes formal policy or not, none of those are green. Like, none of those refer to climate or anything else. So what does the Green Party in the UK stand for on environmental issues now? Or do we know?
Well, that's another good question. And I think it didn't, you know, go unnoticed that Hannah Spencer, in her acceptance speech, you know, spoke much more about, you know, the inequality and wealth gap in the UK than she did about the environmental nature. There was a nod to litter and air quality, but that was it. So I think there is a sort of sense that the Green Party is moving away from its sort of environmental green core and is more a sort of repository for some of the socialist ideas that were previously championed by Jeremy Corbyn, but the sort of current Labour Party has shelved.
Lucy, could I circle back to Labour for a moment? There's three people I want to ask you about. Andy Burnham, Keir Starmer, Rachel Reeves. Let's start off with Andy Burnham. He's the Greater Manchester Mayor, and the elephant in the room in the election is the fact that he wasn't invited to run. He probably is the biggest challenger to Keir Starmer's leadership should he lead a heave. What can you tell us about the dynamics of what his prevention of being on the ticket is saying about the internal dynamics of the Labour Party in the UK?
Well, look, I think, you know, Andy Burnham is the most popular person in Labour nationally, and therefore there are a lot of recriminations being hurled at Keir Starmer for, you know, failing to allow him to have been on the ticket for Gorton and Denton. However, it's not clear-cut. You know, such is the sort of threat from the Green Party in the area that it's clear that, you know, it could have, if Andy Burnham had stepped down from the mayoralty and there had been a by-election there, that Labour could have ceded that potentially to the Greens. So it's not clear-cut.
And do you think that he wasn't allowed to go to protect Keir Starmer's own position in the party? Was it that strategic? And perhaps I'm being cynical?
Yes, I think in a word it was. You know, Andy Burnham had made no secret of the fact he wanted to challenge Starmer for the leadership. He essentially launched a pitch last September, right around the time of the party conference, talking about a business-friendly socialism and making explicitly clear that, you know, Labour MPs were, as he would have it, you know, urging him to run and challenge Starmer for the premiership. So I'm not at all surprised that Starmer and those around him in Downing Street did not want that intrigue in Westminster, and allowing Burnham to return to Parliament would have effectively have started the firing gun on a leadership challenge.
Well, Keir Starmer is not short of critics, and one of them is now in the White House. He described him this week as being no Winston Churchill. And of course, he's had to make some pretty big decisions about his position and indeed the UK's position on the evolving war. What did you make of his defence of that position during Prime Minister's Questions this week on Wednesday?
Well, look, he very much clung to this line that, you know, he was not prepared to take Britain into a war without a clear, you know, well thought through, viable plan for what comes next. And, you know, he has called for a cool head as things escalate in the Middle East and potentially even beyond the region. I think, to my mind, the most interesting thing at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday was actually the stance adopted by Kemi Badenoch, who is essentially arguing for Britain to sort of be an active participant in the war. She's saying that we're in this war whether we like it or not, and that it's not on for the UK to rely on allies to do what it should be doing itself. Her point being that she believes that UK RAF jets should be carrying out the strikes on Iranian missiles in the region and not leaving it to the US to do.
I saw that. And that's not the first time she said that. She seems to have been quite a staunch supporter of the US position. And if anything, saying that the UK isn't taking enough action, just like you've said there. What is she trying to do? I don't know if that would necessarily be representative of the British public. Is it to make sure that the Tory position is, you know, that there's clear blue water between them and Labour or the other? Well, I don't know if you could call it a main party anymore, but what's she trying to do there?
I think it's a really good question, because the polling I've seen this week by YouGov shows that far more people among the British public are against the US strikes than are for them. More people are against the UK allowing the US to use British bases for their strikes than are for that policy that Keir Starmer has rolled out. You know, to speculate, I think Kemi Badenoch may be looking to align herself with Trump and the US, you know, shaping up for, you know, the Conservatives to be sort of seen as, you know, aligned with the MAGA movement and Trump's administration, in the hope of Trump, you know, heaping more criticism on Starmer and his government, there being more ruptures between the US and the UK in a way that could potentially play into, you know, the Conservative Party's hands in the lead up to the next election. But I think it is, you know, surprising even to some in her party that she is taking quite such a hawkish view on the situation, when, you know, so many people watching what's happening in the Middle East, you know, are expecting this to sort of, you know, spiral into chaos.
Mm. It's intriguing. And I did spot that. So thank you for bringing that up. It was an area that I wanted to talk to you about. Can I just go to Rachel Reeves now for a moment? Because the spring statement was out this week. And what I found so ironic, and there's so much I could ask you about in that statement, but Rachel Reeves said that the single most important precondition for economic growth is stability. Of all things the world doesn't have this week is stability. I'm sure that that speech was written quite some time ago, but at the same time, an awful lot of what the OBR is forecasting. And the picture was relatively okay in terms of the main areas. Like, there was 1.1% economic growth predicted. There was the inflation figures, the employment figures, etc. But an awful lot of that then seemed out of date, because if the energy prices that we have spoken about in this show today, if those translate into higher energy bills for the British household or the UK household, that is going to draw a big red line through everything she said during the week, isn't it?
I think that's right. And in a sense, the spring forecast was just overclipped by the fast-moving situation in Iran. You know, there could be a vast effect on household energy bills and the public finances from the situation that's evolving in Iran and the region, and on oil and gas production. So while I think she was wanting to present this as a very boring statement that, you know, we were seeing some signs of green shoots, and what Treasury officials were briefing in the lead up to the spring statement was a boring dividend, you know, unfortunately, the world is no longer playing ball on being boring. Things are very, you know, dynamic indeed in terms of the war that's taking place. And therefore, you know, I think she held back from sort of trying to draw too much attention to, you know, the falling interest and inflation rate.
Lucy, if there's one thing 2026 can't be described as, It's boring, that's for sure. Thank you very much indeed for joining me. Lucy Fisher is Whitehall editor at the Financial Times and host of the FT's Political Fix podcast. Thanks indeed for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Susan A's Culleton here on News Talk. And after the break, how Paramount triumphed over Netflix. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Culleton. Now, for my trivia this week, before I give my question to you, I want to read out a message here from a listener. So this is Aidan Hart, who says, I continue to be a great fan and don't think I've ever used that term before. Taking Stock is excellent and I'm nearly scoring 100% on trivia. I think I only missed one. Well, Aidan, that is some compliment and some achievement at the same time. Let's hear how you fared this week. Right. My mum's sister and my dad's sister are both called Mary and both celebrated the same big birthday in the past month. Now, I'm not mentioning any numbers, but it did get me thinking about big birthday celebrations in our society. So here's my trivia question. Each of the following are celebrating the same big birthday. The Nespresso capsule espresso system patent, gourmet jelly beans, the body shop, the floppy disk and the Ford Fiesta. What big birthday are all of those celebrating? Have a think and I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. Now, Hollywood just had its own plot twist. After months of drama, Paramount Skydance has just trumped Netflix's plan to buy Warner Brothers Discovery with a bid worth about $111 billion, forcing the streaming giant to walk away from one of the biggest media deals in history. This isn't just about media rights, it's about who controls news networks like CNN and how cultural and political battles spill into business. So I'm going to turn to the best in the business, namely the inimitable John Fardy, presenter of Screen Time and producer of Taking Stock here at News Talk to find out more. OK, John, we talked about this last November.
Yes.
And at the time, it looked to be quite certain that Netflix was going to be the one who was going to own Warner Brothers. What's happened since?
You know, a version in house terms, they'd almost gone sale agreed. And people were, you know, wringing their hands going, this is the end of the cinema. Netflix are taking over Warner Brothers. So there was a few I's to be dotted and T's to be crossed. But in the meantime, Paramount were continuing a very hostile bid process, tender process. For people who don't know, Paramount is now run by a man called Daniel Elliott, whose father, and this is very relevant, I would suggest, is Larry Elliott, who's a very rich American man, a Trump supporter, who founded and owns Oracle, and they have a huge amount of money. So Paramount really wanted Warner, because Paramount have had their own troubles over the years, lots of debt. They were taken over 3 years ago. Anyway, they kept raising the ante. Now, Warner suggested that they just didn't think they had enough cash reserves. And there are minutiae to this, but the final blow, in the positive sense of the phrase, from Paramount's point of view, was basically he got Daddy to back the loan. And he went, in crude terms, guarantor on all this money. Larry Ellison signing up for this, basically saying, we will back all these loans, seems to have been the thing that got it over the line. Because, as you said, they upped the share price to $31, which translates as just shy of $111 billion, which is absolutely incredible.
And just to highlight the perseverance here, Paramount went 8 times with the deal. I mean, this is not one and done or two or three. 8 times. They really wanted this, John, didn't they?
They really did. And someone said, you know, this was existential for them. This was part of their future. Whereas for Netflix, you know, Ted Sarandos has come out now basically saying, look, it would have been nice, but no big deal. Now, interestingly, the Netflix share price was hemorrhaging during this prolonged bid process, now is recovering quite significantly. So to talk in your terms, the market like that Netflix haven't got it. But this was a huge deal for them, and their future, Paramount's, was probably in question had they not gotten this. Now, we should explain to listeners what they now have. They have the entire Warner cinema stable. So that's all the legacy things from Batman and Harry Potter. But if you look at the movies that are top of people's minds this year in terms of Oscars, Sinners, One Battle After Another, they are Warner. What's doing great in the box office at the moment, Wuthering Heights, they are Warner. So this is a huge thing to own. They will also own HBO and and HBO Max, which is coming imminently to these shores, which is going to be a separate streaming service. And they will have things like lots of new arrivals, but legacy things like The Sopranos and Sex and the City. So this is a huge deal for them. So like $111 billion sounds like a huge amount, but they are actually, you could argue, getting a huge amount for it. And that doesn't even mention CNN and the CBS News
and
channel.
Which I definitely want to get into. But before I do, I want to go back to the point there that you made about the share price of Netflix, because the share price of Paramount increased quite significantly as well last Friday when this deal was done. Interestingly, Warner Brothers, though, the share price fell slightly. So how is it that the market seemed to be happy with one that it has walked away, the other that it has bought it? It just sounds incongruous then.
It does. But from Warner's point of view, you know, there have been talk, dreaded word, synergies.
Okay.
So, I mean, this,
is that a euphemism for cost cutting?
Well, one would have thought so. And I mean, to be entirely crude about it, you can't help but think there probably must be synergies if one massive studio takes over another, right?
Well, David Ellison actually highlighted this, and they are heading for a reported $6 billion cost cutting target. So that's what synergies
and Netflix
are.
Netflix have countered saying they think it's going to be more than that as well. But Netflix would obviously say that. But the other aspect of this that we haven't mentioned and you alluded to in your intro was there is a, like most things in America, but closer to the surface than you think, there is a kind of culture war dimension to this as well. Because, and by, people might not even be aware of this, but Netflix in some circles is seen as being leftist and progressive. Not in terms of how they treat their staff or whatever, that may or may not be true, but in terms of their content. And you might think, what?
I am thinking what?
Well, so the critics, well, or the people who point this stuff out would say a lot of the shows certainly put diversity and inclusion front and centre in a lot of their shows. There is a lot of leftist viewpoints in some of the shows. Now, you have to really squint to see that, I would suggest. You know, there is a myriad of stuff on Netflix, and there is all sorts of, you know, political viewpoints in various characters. So to me, that's a stretch. But it gets even more bizarre, I would suggest, to things like the New York Post a couple of days ago. And that's a paper that is not, and this is fair to say, shy about turning hearsay into front page news, you know. And there are a lot of people who have very little time for the New York Post. They won't be able to sue us. They're too far away. However, it is alleged that Netflix, in a meeting with government officials in Los Angeles in the run-up to this, had a group of people from the state office in looking at the checks and balances of this deal, and three of them commented on the fact that when they went to the men's rooms, they were shocked to find tampons in the men's rooms. And they thought this, you know, really pointed to the fact that Netflix were far too concerned about diversity and inclusion than they should be. Now, that is hearsay, but it just goes to show how everything in America at the moment does seem to come down, or so many things, particularly where money's involved, to left and right. And of course, they're going to have CNN now, which is a whole can of worms in and of itself. Sorry, I should let you speak, really, shouldn't I?
Well, so what I am wondering about, though, is the latest offer, as you say, is $31 a share.
Yeah.
It comes with a 25 cent per share quarterly fee. If the deal drags past the end of September, a $7 billion break fee if something doesn't happen. Like, notwithstanding the politics and the culture and the commercial alignment with what Warner Brothers actually does, this also must come down to money. I mean, this is an extraordinary amount of money that's being handed over here. Yeah. Is it worth it?
I guess Paramount think it is. I mean, there are eye-watering figures. And as you're going through the stuff there, like, there's all these clauses in it. It's very safe from Warner's point of view. But it points to the fact that they were, it seems quite literally, the Ellison family were prepared to give them anything they wanted to get it. Is it worth it? I mean, I hate to sound like an economist, but time will tell, right? I mean,
The market seemed to think so.
The market seemed to think so. And as I pointed out, they control so much stuff that people want in terms of the cinema and you know, legacy brands, and they have a strong streamer now in their arsenal. Paramount Plus, it is fair to say, have their streaming offer has ebbed and flowed. It's certainly way down the list of Netflix, Apple, Disney, you know what I mean? So now adding HBO into that, that is huge. So, you know, you could be cautiously optimistic about it, but the cinema goer is probably going to benefit. Now, it's a crude kind of simplification to say if Netflix took over, cinema was going to be ruined. Netflix are a different beast, but they show plenty of things in the cinema, albeit for a shorter period of time. Like, for instance, this very week, Peaky Blinders, the movie, is going to cinemas. Now, it's going to be there for the guts of a week until it goes onto a streamer. So I don't think it would necessarily mean the death knell of cinema if Netflix had taken over Warner. But it is probably better for the time being that Paramount took over. Apparently, and again, this is hearsay, but Tom Cruise, who is a big player in all this, who is the darling of Paramount, was very keen that that Paramount take over Warner and not Netflix.
John, you're like the lady Whistledown, to take a Netflix analogy here.
Very
you're like
good.
The lady.
I like what you did.
The lady Whistledown he of
was,
what's going on.
He was very concerned about Netflix taking over Warner by all accounts, because in fairness to Tom Cruise, he has been, you know, the savior of cinema is overstating it, but certainly during the pandemic, he wanted the latest Mission Impossible movie to be in the cinema and filmed it during COVID. There was a famous viral clip of him going very irate when he thought people weren't following the rules and all that kind of stuff. He believes in cinema, and Tom Cruise is a big power player. So it would appear he had some, he certainly helped sway matters, you know.
Well, when I spoke to you about this last November, there was a focus really on exactly that point, the death knell of cinema competition in the area. I find now that the tone has moved towards competition around news.
Yeah.
And like David Ellison, he's got no background in journalism.
No,
and
he was an aspiring actor at one stage, yeah.
And so therefore, David Ellison, who is going to be running the show, is set to end up in charge of two of America's most prominent news organizations, CNN and CBS.
Yeah.
Certainly one might question if they would merge. And then there is also the question about where the leaning of CNN might be. Then, for all intents and purposes, the world is expected to lean to the right so that it's closer to Fox. So what does this mean for the future of news then?
It's fascinating, if a little scary. I mean, let's not forget Trump, President Trump, as we're meant to call him, did have eyes on this and initially said when Netflix were looking likely, I have a problem with that. He backpedaled a bit and then kind of said, I don't have a problem with any of this. He has certainly had problems with CNN in the past.
That's right, Chanya.
And, you know, you would think he's quite happy that the Ellisons are taking over CNN, and you can't help but think they are going to start leaning in a different direction, as has been the Washington Post, you know.
And so when we look at this then, like, you and I have spoken over the past couple of months about things like central bank independence and obviously military interventions that President Trump has made. Is he now being right front and centre at what people see across the majority of news networks across America?
Yeah, it's heading that way. And this is probably bad for people who are worried about that kind of thing. The fact that one of his, certainly the dad, Ellison, is a keen supporter of him. So it's problematic. It's also problematic, I suppose, in that there are now a very small number of middle-aged white men who, I said white twice there.
Of which you're one yourself.
Yes, indeed. Who now, I'm more hair than they do, thankfully, but who now control huge swathes of entertainment and news in America. So it's worrying times, but I do come back to the point that I think it's probably, certainly from a cinema and streaming point of view, it's probably good times for the viewer, because the cinema, a big cinema house, Warner, is now in the hands of another big cinema house, Paramount, and yet they have streamers and they're going to go toe to toe with Netflix. So you would have to think ultimately the viewer, be it in the cinema or at home, are going to win.
If I was in the C-suite of Netflix, I would imagine that I'd have been planning for what was going to happen when we bought Warner. Now that isn't happening.
Yeah.
And they've been very clear they want to double their ad revenue. They want to extend their geographical footprint. Obviously, they want to continue with big box hits like Bridgerton, who I had referred to earlier on, etc. How do you think the development of Netflix's strategy now is going to be, given this new, almost unexpected development in recent weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. And they were, despite what Saranda says, they were very keen to get a big studio house like that because they don't have huge amounts of cinema legacy. They might have a lot of TV legacy. So they will be on the lookout for other studios. The problem is there aren't really that many up for sale. But I think you're going to see more moves into live events, sport. Mm-hmm. That's going to become the new battleground because Warner and Paramount have their own skin in that game as well. Live events as well, like stuff like, you know, award ceremonies. It's not going to be the Oscars because that's on YouTube, who we haven't even touched, which are a whole other army coming over the hill in terms of what's going to be up for grabs and all. And but I think in a way they're going to try and continue to make more event TV that everyone's going to talk about, and you will see a doubling down. And you know, I think I might have said this to you the last time, but again, it's a simplification when people talk about the Netflixization of things. But Netflix, unlike Spotify, will pay the people who write these TV shows and movies. They will pay the costume designers. They will pay the actors. Actors might not get as many residuals as they used to from DVD sales, but it is important to remember that Netflix doesn't mean the end of storytelling because they pay the people who tell stories. Maybe they pay them slightly less in more streamlined ways, and there isn't as much of a, as I say, residual to it, but they still continue to pay people who want to tell stories. And that's a good thing, no matter what happens. Whereas Spotify have a much different model that's causing havoc to the music industry that isn't happening in TV and movies to the same extent.
Well, John, when we had our production meeting earlier on this week and you asked me what guest I had in mind for this slot, you were my first choice, and I think listeners can now hear why. Thank you very much indeed to, as I say, the inimitable John Faraday, presenter of Screen Time and producer of Taking Stock here at News Talk. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you.
This is Susan Ace Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And up next, why exactly America is at war with Iran. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Ace Cullerton. For decades, Iran has been the arch enemy of both Israel and the US, accused of sponsoring terrorism and secretly chasing a nuclear bomb. Something it has always denied, but now with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps launching strikes across the region and Tehran rushing to appoint a new supreme leader, we are in genuinely uncharted territory. I want to look at what this power shift inside Iran might mean for the rest of us. And joining me now is Dennis Staunton of the Irish Times. So, Dennis, first of all, we have seen enormous amounts of developments happening over the past week. But what I am wondering is whether you can give us clarity on why Trump himself has been so single-minded about going ahead with this. In his first 72 hours, he said he wanted to eliminate Iran's nuclear weapons program, end Iran's ability to export terrorism, overthrow its regime, or find a new leader inside it with whom he could do business. What does the US want?
That's a very good question. And as you say, he's given a number of different answers to that question. If we go back to when it started, so last week you had negotiations going on between the United States and Iran about Iran's nuclear program. And Iran is allowed to enrich uranium up to a certain point, but really only for civilian use. But everybody has thought that they're trying to enrich it to the point where they can develop a nuclear weapon. And last year in the summer, Israel and the US went and they bombed some of Iran's nuclear facilities. And now they were trying to get to this deal, basically, where Iran would agree to verifiably give up all its nuclear ambitions. But the Americans seem to want a bit more as well. They wanted to destroy or to give up their conventional ballistic missiles as well. Anyway, these talks were going on. And then suddenly the Americans and the Israelis decided that they were actually going nowhere, and that they had to go in and attack Iran. And as you say, first of all, it was about not allowing Iran to get a nuclear weapon. But those negotiations had been sort of getting somewhere, according to the foreign minister of Oman, who was the mediator between the two sides. And then they were suggesting that it was actually about getting rid of this regime. And then they were saying it was kind of in support of the people who had been protesting in Iran over the last few months, thousands of whom were killed by the Iranian regime. And so it's really not clear exactly what the purpose is. What is clear, though, is what's happening. And so they have killed the leadership, including the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and also a lot of other leadership figures. in the system. And then, as you say, the Iranians have lashed out, not just at Israel, but and not only at American installations in the region, but all over the region, in the Gulf states. You've seen in places like Dubai, in Saudi Arabia, in Bahrain, and in Qatar, all of these Iranian attacks going on.
If we're not clear on why they've gone in, I find it hard to understand what could get them out. Because if we were to look at this from a US point of view, if we had a Venezuela-type scenario where whoever replaces Khamenei, of which Israel said would be a clear target for elimination, but let's say whoever does replace him, and let's say then that they put forward a modified nuclear deal, some sort of oil concession, some sort of commercial deal, and some sort of tolerable type agreement with the US, this could be seen as a totally missed opportunity for Israel. So how does the US and Israel then square the circle together about how this looks on the off-ramp, out of this situation?
I think you're identifying a very important point, which is that although Israel and the Americans are in this together, they actually have different interests and they probably have different aims out of this. For Israel, destroying the regime is the main aim. And even if that leaves Iran as a failed state in chaos, that's better as far as they're concerned. And they're used to living in chaos, but they would just want this weakened Iran. For the Americans, I think that the scenario you were outlining, something like in Venezuela, where you leave the regime more or less in place, but you find somebody more amenable to deal with, you then get them back to the negotiating table and you get a better deal out of them. That would suit the Americans, and it would particularly suit Iran's neighbors in the Gulf and in the region. And so I think what we're going to find out over the next few days or few weeks is exactly how they do this. But in the end, the Americans are the leading party. They're the most powerful. And so if we go back, for example, to the summer of last year, the Israelis went in with the Americans to bomb Iran. The Israelis would have quite happily carried on. But at a certain stage, after 12 days, the Americans said, that's enough. And now let's stop. And so for domestic political reasons, but also in a way because of his view of the world and of America's place in it, Donald Trump doesn't really want to have a prolonged war. He doesn't want to have something like Iraq and Afghanistan. He doesn't want to start sending American forces in there to try to rebuild a, you know, to change the regime and rebuild a new kind of state in America's image. So I would say that you know, if there is an opportunity to find, you know, maybe through some kind of back channel diplomacy, which I imagine is going on even now as the bombs are falling, if they can find some way that they can have, you know, find some kind of interlocutor who will agree to some face-saving formula, because it's, I would say, in both the interests of the United States, of the region, and also obviously of Iran, for this thing to end as soon as it can.
Let's say all of that happens. How then does Iran build a new, I'm going to use that same word, regime? Because in that Truth Social message that went out last weekend, President Trump was calling on people to rise up to the challenge and that this was their opportunity and so on. I was in a taxi in Vancouver in January, and the taxi driver was Iranian, and he was clearly, clearly very stressed about his family, who he was telling me had been part of the protests and all of what happened there. And so I was thinking, for that man's family, what does the person on the ground, the civilian on the ground in Iran, how do they live their lives within a new regime? Like, how exactly would a new regime, even, or whether democratic or otherwise, actually be formed? And Iran has already formed a transitional leadership council. It's got 88 senior clerics. As I say, if it creates a new supreme leader, Israel said that that's going to be a clear target anyway. Like, how exactly does Iran rebuild itself?
Well, there is no obvious alternative to the current system. And so I think what we're talking about is some kind of reform from within the system. Now, the death of Ali Khamenei is probably important where this is concerned. He was 86. He had been in a leadership role for nearly 40 years. And so the fact that he's gone and some other leadership figures around him are gone possibly does open the possibility that there are other elements, both within the Revolutionary Guard and elsewhere in the system, who are more moderate. And it's an extremely sophisticated society. And they are, you know, the people in the Iranian government are highly sophisticated people. And so that you could find that there is a sort of a shift away from the clerical religious element towards something which is more military. I don't think it would be more democratic. I mean, there is a form of democracy that operates in the Islamic Republic, but I don't think it would be like a liberal democracy or anything like that. But I think the key thing where the ordinary person is concerned is that the economy is in a terrible state, mainly because of American sanctions. And so if there was a resolution of the nuclear issue, then that means there's sanctions relief. And so any government, no matter what its ideology is in Iran, that's able to negotiate an end to the American sanctions, that immediately improves the lives of people, or very quickly it does, because it just brings economic activity, the possibility of economic hope and of hope for better lives back to people. So I would say that the most likely benign scenario, at least, would be that you have some kind of a change from within the administration, but that essentially the system would remain the same.
Many things there, Dennis, need to go right in order to get to that point.
Yeah, and also many things need not to go wrong. And the problem with war is that it's very difficult to control. It's dynamic and it's chaotic. And you're only in control up to a point of the part that you're actually doing yourself, and you can't really control what the enemy is doing. So accidents can happen. And one of the variables here is what happens with the Gulf states. It's quite clear that at the beginning, and or indeed before the beginning, that the Gulf states, people like the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates and people like that, they didn't want this to happen. And then once it did happen, they were very careful to signal their neutrality initially. And they were saying, you know, we didn't allow the Americans to use our airspace or our territory to launch attacks on Iran. And so they were hoping that might protect them from Iranian retaliation. The Iranians say they're only attacking American installations in all of these places, but it doesn't feel that if you're in Dubai. And so the question is, if the Saudis are provoked so much that actually, instead of just wanting this to end, that they feel that they have to hit back at Iran, that then you could find a kind of a further escalation. Or indeed, as you've seen, Israel is already escalating in that it's sped the conflict to Lebanon, and it's now attacking Lebanon and attacking Hezbollah there. So I think that you can, you know, like, so in a way, it's not just that you need things to go right, but you just need to try to contain it. And that's where time is very important. The sooner this ends, the better, in terms of trying to find a solution. And also, just where the economics of it is concerned, at the moment, you know, shipping is very badly hit, energy, but you know, you can probably cope with no oil coming out of that region for a week or two. If it's not coming out for about 3 weeks, then suddenly people's reserves start to run down, and then you really get into a difficult position. And that, as you know, can affect everywhere in the world.
Now, you brought up the point there about supply. And what we have automatically seen is the change in price. European gas prices surged more than 70%. That was just by Wednesday. In the UK, we saw gas prices almost doubling. It was the fastest change ever, and by far had outpaced the change as a result of the invasion into Ukraine. We're also seeing at this point the almost collapse of Iraq's crude production. How do you see this changing from politics and military into an economic argument?
Well, these are both going on at the same time. And again, I think, you know, if you look, say, at the energy stuff, you know, clearly those price spikes happen very quickly. But also if, say, it's just a question of ships not being able to get through the Strait of Hormuz, this narrow passage, near Iran, if they just can't get out of there and then suddenly the thing ends, then they immediately start getting out again. The problem is, say, if the energy infrastructure starts to be damaged. So, and that can be everything from, oil fields or gas installations themselves to, say, port facilities. And so if you then have, infrastructure damage, which takes much longer to repair, then you're really getting into a difficult position where your supplies are running low. And obviously the whole situation in Ukraine and Russia complicates matters because, say, in Europe, European countries, for the most part, stopped buying gas and to some extent oil from Russia, and they started sourcing it elsewhere, a lot of that from America, a lot of it from Qatar. And so it's already a kind of a fairly tight situation when it comes to all of this, say for places like Europe. And it's also particularly difficult for Asia, because 84% of the energy that was going through that area was going to Asia. And so countries like India, China, they're really dependent on getting resources from there. China's probably okay where oil is concerned, partly because it's got a huge amount in reserve, but also because it can get more from Russia. And but gas is a problem if that runs out.
And finally, Dennis, I do want to get your take on the political view in Europe. We have seen Spain call the war a disaster. Germany is travelling to Washington next week with a view to trying to build relationships with Trump and is trying to, assuage its view there. We also see France now talking more about nuclear than in the past. How do you see and never mind what even happened with Keir Starmer, of course, and him being no Winston Churchill. How do you see the European response? Because it doesn't sound all that unified.
It's not entirely unified, although for the most part they have, while sort of muttering disapproval about international law, or at least muttering about international law, most of them have not really broken with Trump, and they've really focused on condemning the Iranian retaliation. But as this goes on, the Spanish position starts to look a bit more attractive. So what you've seen in the last couple of days, for example, is the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, who his first reaction was to go and essentially endorse the American and Israeli attack. A couple of days later, he was singing a different tune. So I think that as it goes on, and as the as time goes on, that maybe you will see positions shifting, as you saw Keir Starmer's position shifting, you saw the position of Mark Carney, and nobody really wants to antagonize Donald Trump unnecessarily, but at the same time, nobody particularly wants to make themselves a target for anything that's going to happen. And that's the problem if you get too close to something like this, that as Britain found when its installations in Cyprus were attacked immediately afterwards, you can make yourself a target, and nobody in Europe wants that either.
Well, thank you for taking us right around the world there, Dennis, in a very fast-moving situation. It is one, of course, that we will be looking at very closely in the days and weeks to come. Thank you very much for joining me, Dennis Daunton of the Irish Times.
Thank you.
Now, for the answer to my trivia. I was telling you that my mum's sister and my dad's sister, both called Mary, both celebrated the same big birthday in the past month. And I'm not mentioning what birthday it is, but it did get me thinking about big birthday celebrations. And here was the trivia question that I gave you. I said, each of the following are celebrating the same big birthday: the Nespresso capsule espresso system patent, gourmet jelly beans, the body shop, the floppy disk, and the Ford Fiesta. So what big birthday are they celebrating? The answer is 50. Nestlé patented the capsule espresso system in Switzerland in 1976, which was the same year as the jelly bean range of gourmet jelly beans debuted, which was the same year as Anita Roddick founded the body shop in Brighton, which was the same year as the Ford Fiesta was built in Valencia, which was the same year as the floppy disk storage device was introduced decades before the cloud. So happy birthday to all of them. And of course, in a most heartfelt way, happy birthday to both of my Auntie Marys. And that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan A's Culleton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, also, of course, my guest today. And on research this week was Stephen Daunt. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. I look forward already to talking to you again next week.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Culleton.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Keeping your business fleet moving with service you can count on.
This is News Talk.